You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Thank you all so much for coming, and thanks very much to the Open Society Institute, and especially to Steve Hubbell for putting the program together. For those of you who aren't familiar with it, George Soros founded the Open Society Institute in 1993 to provide assistance to former Soviet bloc countries to establish more transparent and accountable democratic governments. More recently, OSI has expanded its network. It now encompasses the U.S. and more than 60 countries in Europe, Asia, Africa, and Latin America. It's also expanded its initial mission of promoting democracy and human rights to improving the lives of marginalized people around the world. So those of us who have dedicated significant portions of our lives to the challenge of global warming are especially grateful to OSI for its newfound attention to the global environment. So for that, many, many thanks to OSI from the entire panel. Let me say a few words to frame tonight's discussion. Global climate change has at long last made its way into the U.S. press, but the press is still doing a dismal job in portraying the imminence and magnitude of the problem. As we know, the glaciers are melting, the deep oceans are heating, violent weather is increasing, the ranges of infectious disease are expanding, the timing of the seasons is changing, and all over the world, plants, birds, insects, fish, and animals are migrating toward the poles in search of stable temperatures. And all that has happened from 1 degree of warming. And for context, unchecked, we're looking to a future of 4 to 10 degrees more warming later in this century. I think we could well be standing at the threshold of runaway changes. For the purposes of this evening, it's important to understand that climate impacts hit poor countries hardest, not because nature discriminates against the poor, but because most poor countries don't have the resources to prepare the infrastructures to buffer them against these climate impacts. The most immediate consequence and the most visible one of accelerating climate change lies in its impact in millions of people around the world whose crops are destroyed by weather extremes, whose homelands are going under from rising sea levels, and whose borders will be overrun by environmental refugees. Viewed from another perspective, through the lens of human rights, there is a strong totalitarian threat embedded in climate change. When governments are confronted by breakdowns, they have no choice in many cases but to resort to totalitarian methods to keep order in the face of chaos. So given the conditions under which we're living, it's not hard to foresee a short-term state of emergency morphing into a long-term state of siege. On the other hand, I strongly believe that a real solution to the climate crisis has the potential to create immensely positive changes in global dynamics. A properly structured, globally coordinated program to rewire the world with clean energy would create millions and millions of jobs all over the world. It would begin to turn dependent and impoverished countries into trading partners. It would bring all the countries of the world together around a common global project that transcends national alliances and regional antagonisms. It would jump the renewable energy industry into being a central driving engine of growth of the global economy. And I think ultimately it would lead to a far more prosperous, secure, and peaceful world. The goal of most climate activists during the last 15 years is centered on what's called mitigation, the phasing out of our burning of coal and oil. But there's another goal that has been gathering more attention as the world comes to realize that climate impacts will continue to intensify no matter how quickly we can transition to a non-carbon economy. That goal is known in the trade as adaptation. It focuses on ways to minimize the impacts of climate shocks on vulnerable populations. For the longest time, many environmentalists resisted the importance of adaptation, largely because it carries the connotation of surrendering to climate change rather than stopping it. But as the pace of warming continues to accelerate far more rapidly than the scientists thought even 5 years ago, many now believe that some strategic adaptation initiatives are critical if we're going to maintain some geopolitical stability. Parenthetically, it's worth recalling that this phenomenon affects not only remote regions. Stephen Chu, our new Secretary of Energy, recently expressed concerns about the collapse of agriculture in California later in this century. So while we will begin by discussing West Africa, we will also be talking about our own social futures as well. This evening, we will begin by focusing on one microcosm of adaptation aimed at emerging food crises in Mali, Burkina Faso, and Senegal. Parenthetically, I put a quote on my website about a year ago from Kasko Ajikara, a farmer in Niger, who told a reporter, "When the rainy season starts late, crops fail and people suffer. Children eat leaves. In that situation, only God can help us." I fervently hope that sessions like this might also generate some more mundane sources of help for Mr. Ajikara and his children. Our two presenters will speak for about 15 minutes on each on various aspects of food security in West Africa. After that, we'd like to segue into a more general discussion of some of the social and economic and political dimensions of climate crisis. And at that point, we look forward to all of you joining the panel with your own questions, your own insights, and of course, your inevitable, but hopefully civil, disagreements. Tonight's panelists are Dr. Sarah Scheer and Mark Hertzgaard. Dr. Scheer is an agricultural economist who has devoted her professional life to agricultural and forestry policies and practices in poor countries. In addition to publishing 37 articles in the refereed literature, she has authored or contributed to 13 books. Dr. Scheer recently founded Eco Agriculture Partners, a Washington-based NGO devoted to improving sustainable agricultural and land use policies in developing countries. She's a member of the Advisory Panel on Food Security to the United Nations Environment Program. She has served on the Task Force on Hunger for the UN Millennium Project. She has been an adjunct professor at the University of Maryland, a senior research fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute, and a principal researcher at the World Agroforestry Center in Nairobi. We are extremely fortunate to be the beneficiaries of her expertise and her insights this evening. Mark Hertzgaard is a world-class journalist and author who's been writing about global warming for about 20 years. In 1983, he published his first environment book, Nuclear Inc. In 1988, he published On Bended Knee, which was a piercing critique of the failure of the press to report critically on the Reagan administration. Subsequently, Mark financed out of his own pocket an extraordinary journey to 19 countries in order to put together a ground-level first-hand assessment of the state of the global environment. His effort culminated in 1998 in publication of a remarkable book, Earth Odyssey, Around the World in Search of Our Environmental Future. Mark is an extremely accomplished author who's written for The Nation, New Yorker, Vanity Fair, The Atlantic Monthly, and many other outlets. And he is currently working on a book that I'm dying to see called Living Through the Storm, How We Survive the Next 50 Years and More of Climate Change. The Open Society Institute is indeed fortunate to have landed Mark as one of its distinguished fellows. My name is Ross Gelspan. I will be moderating and participating in the discussion. Briefly, I was an editor and investigative reporter at for 30 years at the Philadelphia Bulletin, the Washington Post, and the Boston Globe. At the Globe, I conceived, directed, and edited a series of articles that won a Pulitzer Prize. Following my retirement from daily journalism, I got involved in global warming, not because I love the trees. I tolerate the trees. But in fact, it's because I learned the coal industry was paying some scientists under the table to say nothing's happening to the climate. And I said to myself, if there's this cover-up going on, what are they covering up? And there went the next 15 years of my life. Since then, I've published about 150 articles, given several hundred talks, and published two books. The first one, titled The Heat Is On, received national attention when it surfaced in 1997, following a very flattering review by Mark Hertzgaard. It probably didn't hurt that at the same time, then-President Bill Clinton held the book up at a press conference and told the press he was reading it.
Because of that review, I believe.
That's right, absolutely. In 2004, a second book, Boiling Point, received the lead review in the Sunday New York Times Book Review, which was written by Al Gore. During this period, I've been working to promote a bundle of three interactive policy strategies, which we developed with a group of economists and energy policy specialists and developing country policymakers to jumpstart a global program to rewire the world with clean energy. If you're interested, those policies are spelled out on my website in a piece titled Moral Leadership in the Greenhouse. Before I go on, I'd like to give you all three of our websites if you're interested, because they're all extremely rich websites. Sarah's is ecoagriculture.org, Mark's is markhertzgaard.com, and mine is heatisonline.org. So again, thanks so much for all your interest. We look forward to your contributions to the discussion. So with that, Sarah.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here in this panel with the two colleagues here and with all of you. What I want to do to start the conversation is to give a bit more of the overview globally and in Africa about what can we really anticipate seeing as a result of climate change, and what are some of the strategies that are being developed and that exist right now to start a process of adaptation to climate change. And we'll go then from my talk to some of the more specifics of the examples that Mark will do. As Ross was saying, climate change isn't something that's happening in the future. It's actually something that's already begun. We've already got the 1 degree increase. The discussions right now politically are around trying to achieve a concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere of 450 parts per million, because that was what came out of the International Panel on Climate Change's recommendations a number of years ago. Now, if you talk to scientists, they are very concerned about extreme disruption occurring if we allow it to get to 450. And they're saying, no, we need to go to 350 parts per million to actually avoid some of the more catastrophic possibilities that are coming out of the models that they're working on. Now, 350 is actually below where we are now. So there's the challenge is even larger now than I think people thought it was, than scientists thought it was a couple of years ago. And one of the areas that's receiving particular attention now is the area of food production. There was noises being made for a while that, well, you know, actually might be good for food production. You know, temperatures might go up. We're certainly anticipating temperatures are going to go up. Rainfall is going to go up in some places. You know, maybe northern Canada will become the source of food. It actually doesn't look like that kind of rosy scenario is coming out of any of the analyses now. There's actually a number of models. I went back and reviewed a couple of them in preparation for this talk, because I was going to point to the specific areas of the world that they're now predicting are going to be a lot warmer or very much warmer than they currently are, or that will be cooler or very much cooler. And there are really good models that show that. They're not yet completely consistent about where that will be. But one of the places that most of the models are showing very significant impacts is in Africa, with very large areas of Africa being subject to much drier regimes of rainfall and also much hotter temperatures in certain areas. There are some places where that's not the case. But the concern is that even once we get better at pinpointing exactly what the impacts are going to be roughly where, what we're realizing is that significant change needs a response in any event, so that even some of the places that might get better temperatures, quote unquote, or better rainfall, quote unquote, means that they're going to have to make significant changes in their farming systems. They're going to need different varieties. There's going to be a different set of pests and disease complexes as soon as you start to change the temperature and you change the rainfall regimes. So even in the places where some of the models are saying we're not going to expect excessive rainfall, we're not going to expect or drought, we're not going to expect excessive temperatures reductions or increases, that doesn't mean that those places are not going to have to be making some pretty significant changes in terms of their production systems. Some of the models are suggesting that by the year 2050, the average yield of maize, what we call corn in the United States, could be reduced by 17%. This is in the context of adding a couple billion people to the world. And if we look at one of our other major products, which is irrigated rice, some of the predictions are that will decline by the average yield by 20%. Now, these only really look at models of temperature and rainfall. So the changes in pests and diseases and other kinds of impacts that will come from additional flooding and storms and the seeds being basically blown away or washed out of the soil because of extreme weather events are not included in most of those models. So we're talking about really needing to prepare for very substantial changes in our food economy. And that conversation is just barely beginning, and it's currently mostly now with the scientific community and just beginning to get out into the larger public. I find it useful to think of these changes as falling into two categories. One category are just simply places that will be so disrupted that it will not be possible to continue to grow food in them. Areas that are going to be flooded because of sea level rise, or will become too saline basically for production because of sea level rise. The areas where it will simply, we're going to move back, you know, Africa over the centuries has moved, many parts of Africa have moved from being primarily livestock dependent because it was too dry or erratic rainfall for crops to grow to becoming crop producers. And there's very large areas of Africa now that only became crop producers in the last couple of centuries. And many of those areas are actually going to go out of crop production again. And however, in the interim, there have been very significant increases in population during that period who are basically fed by those crops. So there's the piece of it that's going to create the environmental refugees, that's really going to create disaster. That probably won't be most places. That will be in a few very specific kinds of areas. What will happen elsewhere is this need for adaptation. Now, farmers have always had to adapt. I mean, that's just been a part of living, and certainly over the centuries, there have been changes in climate. The issue is that so many more people must be fed on the farmland that we have, and the total farmland around the world has not really increased. It's actually, in many places, decreasing due to degradation, and that could be exacerbated with climate change. So the question is, what is the nature of adaptation? In many places, it's actually not rocket science. We do need some rocket science level science, I think, around some of these places. But there is a great deal that can be done for adaptation that we already know about, that we've learned about by working in parts of the world that have more erratic climates, that have less reliable crop yields. And we've learned what kinds of arrangements actually help such places maintain stable food supplies. So there's sort of, what I think when we're looking for, I want to move now to just some very specific sort of summary of what some of these recommendations are as we think forward to adaptation. I'm going to start with just saying what I think are three of the principles of this. The first one is that we need to be building agricultural landscapes for resilience, which means paying attention not only to the cropland and how that's managed, but also to the whole natural resource base within those, so that we're using water more effectively. We're maintaining forest cover so that it protects soils and watershed functions. We need to be thinking about managing for resilience. Secondly, we need to, whatever we do, to support communities and farmer organizations and farmers to understand what's coming down the pike and to start making plans at the local level, plans in their communities, and plans at the larger at larger scales for managing risks. It's not like you can't manage risks, but it really requires planning. And the third principle. Actually, I want to refer back to what Ross was saying about mitigation, and also to the point that I was making about how much concentration of greenhouse gases we can actually tolerate in terms of human life systems and related natural systems. And that is that if you look at the sources of greenhouse gases around the world, more than 30% of them actually come from the agriculture and land use sectors. And I think this is actually not very well understood. If you look at the climate change negotiations internationally, they're barely talking at all about agriculture. It's just started now. They have very recently started to talk about forests because deforestation is about half of that land use related greenhouse gas emissions, although most of the forest emissions are coming from the drivers of agriculture. So they're very closely linked, means one important conclusion from that is that no approach to trying to mitigate climate change will be successful without a very major initiatives taken around land use. The second piece, which also is not so well known, is at this moment in time, the only technologies that we have that are viable and proven for sequestering, pulling greenhouse gases, particularly carbon, out of the atmosphere is through the process of photosynthesis in our agricultural systems and our natural systems. So any significant effort to do mitigation needs to use the only existing technologies that we have. And I think as soon as people actually do understand that that's the only one we're going to have for at least the next 20 years, while other technologies may be developed that will sequester carbon out of the atmosphere, we really need to be thinking far more strategically about land use and part of that. So just quickly, what are the five key areas for action in adaptation that will both address adaptation and address mitigation? And my view is that they need to be done together. If we're having these two conversations separately, we're going to end up with some really bad ideas being implemented. So what's the first one? The first one is to improve the resilience and yields, productivity of our agricultural areas, and to do it in a way that has more soil organic matter, more root matter under the ground, has less tillage and less sources of emission, less use of chemical fertilizers that produce greenhouse gas, nitrous oxide, and other ones in the places where they're overused, and very judicious use in those places where we're trying to increase productivity in places like Africa. We have some great examples of just doing good agricultural development and sustainable agricultural development in some areas is a major adaptation strategy. Secondly, is to use far more perennials in our agricultural systems. Right now, about a third of all the world's cropland is planted to just a couple of cereals that dominate. There's 3,000 edible plants in the world. And most of what we eat actually comes from just a couple of really 10 main products, and most of them are maize, wheat, and corn. That creates an enormous vulnerability for our food system globally, but also locally, because what we need for risk management is to have diversity within the agricultural systems, so that if certain crops don't work, others will. We also know that we can have much more stability around crop and disease management when you have multiple species in a landscape. So we need to be thinking about this. And there's an enormous amount of perennial vegetation that can be used to substitute for oils and for starches and for particularly for livestock feed, and can serve as safety nets that in years when the crops don't fail, you can use these perennial crops. The third one is we need to be developing climate-resilient, climate-friendly livestock systems. Livestock are responsible for more than 14% of all greenhouse gas emissions. It's actually what you eat matters actually more than how you drive your car. And we need to be looking at how breeds are going to respond to climate change, what kind of feed systems there will be, how will we manage our rangelands. These are all systems. This is barely any work that's going on this right now, but it's going to be really central. The fourth one is to restore the degraded watersheds and really look at managing water much more wisely, much more strategically, vastly expand rainwater harvesting, and not doing it just by putting things on your roof, but actually using what they call green water, which is using vegetation and soils to actually store and manage and absorb rainwater so it's available through the course of the season. A lot of work we can do with that. And then the fifth big area is to protect the existing natural forests and natural grasslands that we have. They play not only a very important role in carbon storage, but also there's a lot of utility from good management of these resources for food safety nets and for supplemental sources of food for as well as biodiversity and watershed management. So there's other things we need to do. We need to play with. We need to really look at strategically thinking about how our market systems work and creating better systems of food stocks at all scales. We need to be looking at new ways of financing activities in agriculture. And one of the main ways we could develop is by using carbon offsets and the greenhouse gas mitigation strategies for financing people, particularly in the developing countries, to restore their watersheds, to store carbon in their soils so that they get higher yields. There's huge potential for this, which is barely being tapped. An estimate is that at $20 per ton of carbon dioxide equivalent, you could actually sequester the equivalent of a quarter of all the fossil fuel emissions. And if it were up to $100 per ton, then the sense is that most of the fossil fuel emissions could actually be offset by land use. We obviously need to be doing more climate adaptation planning at national and other levels to deal with refugees and conflict management and storage of foods. But let me close with just three points about action items. The probably most significant barrier right now to doing any of the things that I've said is how completely we have underinvested in our agriculture, farmer organization, and rural institutions. We are not ready right now to do a major program of the type that Ross was doing. We need to go back and reinvest in those in ways that give farmers and local land users a major voice. We also need to think very differently about our strategies of agricultural development. We had a food crisis a couple of years ago, and boy, was there a lot of press about that. And what was the big response? Well, obviously, short-term, fixing up the short-term screw-ups in the markets that happened. That certainly was an important thing to do. But it's like, we've got a crisis, let's use seed and fertilizer. Now, seed is really important, and fertilizer can be really important, but that is 10% of the issue. And we do not have a societal consensus around developing a new strategy for agricultural development in the U.S. as well as the rest of the world, in a world which, with 9 billion people in the context of climate change and the associated water scarcities, et cetera, that come with that. We're really just at the beginning of thinking that through. And finally, this is a short-term element. We really have to make sure that agriculture is included in Copenhagen and in the international negotiations, and that it actually evolves to take a central role in those strategies for both mitigation and adaptation.
That's great. Thank you, Sarah. It's interesting when you're talking about doing much more education of farmers and preparing them. I happened to give a talk in Lubbock, Texas a few years ago, and I was told to expect to be stoned because this is a conservative part of the country and there were a whole lot of farmers who came to this, and I gave them this explanation of global warming, and they were extremely grateful because they knew from their experience that the soil's drying out too quickly, the plants are blooming out of whack, and they were very grateful for the explanation. So rather than getting a hostile response, I got a very grateful one. So I think that's a very important point. Good. Let's get Mark's two cents worth here, and then we can proceed. This is
okay.
Good.
Before I begin, I want to give a little shout out to, I guess there's 100-plus people who are here online with us. So please stay with us. You outnumber those of us who are here in our corporal sense. And we look forward to your involvement with this. In a second, I want to take you to Western Africa, to Burkina Faso and Mali, where the Open Society Institute recently sent me, I'm grateful to say. But first, I just want to reemphasize something that Sarah said here. For so long, the discussion of climate change has focused on energy, on coal, oil and gasoline, and this is true of us in the press, I think, we have really completely overlooked a part of the puzzle that is roughly equal. Agriculture is roughly equal in terms of its emissions to energy. Sarah said it so quickly you may have missed it, but whether you eat meat is arguably much more important than whether what kind of a car you drive. So as we think about this, agriculture cannot any longer be this footnote, this marginal issue. And this is also, I think, a very positive thing because it is arguably easier to affect your own carbon footprint by changing how you eat than it is to get the United States government to change how it funds transportation. So this can be an empowering piece of knowledge as well. And that's on the mitigation side, and it is really, I think, very encouraging to realize that agriculture, as Sarah just said, offers us a really powerful tool for dealing with what is now an imperative. Because we are so deep into the climate crisis and because the momentum of the Earth's climate system is so advanced, at this point, it's all very well to talk about reducing our emissions. That's important and must be done. It must be a big part of Copenhagen. But we have to go beyond that. We have got to find a way to be pulling the existing carbon out of the atmosphere. Not just let's add less of it as we go along. That will not do the job. We have to find a way to pull the existing carbon out. And what you hear in most of the media, to the extent that it's talked about, is a phrase that you may know, geoengineering. And what they're talking about there is things like putting up giant reflector mirrors between here and the sun, pouring iron filings into the ocean, perhaps putting up sulfites into the atmosphere in the same way that Mount Pinatubo did in the early 90s, because that does have an effect of temporarily cooling the atmosphere. Those ideas are controversial and perhaps deserve investigation, but they are very expensive and very, very dangerous. They could very well make things worse. Compare that to what Sarah mentioned, photosynthesis, and which does that naturally, and finding ways to use that that natural process here on the Earth is a real one of my sources, the top climate advisor to the government of Germany, just said this week, and this is one of the last jokers up our sleeve. And the capacity for agriculture to do this is really astonishing. Between the soil itself and the plants and vegetation that grow on the soil, we have the capacity to basically sequester virtually all of the annual emissions that go up every year from this planet. Think about that. If we change our agricultural system, we can actually start to turn the clock back on how much carbon is up there. And that is vitally important now. And, as I will try and say in my remaining time, it also happens to be something that is very valuable for the poor farmers and poor people throughout the third world in the rural areas who are bearing the brunt of this. It is one of the happy coincidences that at a time when mitigation and adaptation have got to work hand in hand, that the agricultural field really is a place where this can happen. And so if you take anything out of tonight, take this, that agriculture not only matters as much as energy, but that the solutions to climate change in the field of agriculture are much more available, much quicker, and much cheaper than what we're trying to do with energy. That's not to say we don't do energy as well, but agriculture is a real missed opportunity so far. And I wholeheartedly agree with what Sarah said about Copenhagen. That has got to be something that is really pressured between now and December to get agriculture high up on the agenda there. So with that as a preface, let me take you please to Burkina Faso and Mali. And Niger. I did not get to Niger, but Niger is the reason I went to Burkina Faso and Mali, because it is one of the great success stories that we have in the field of climate change and agriculture. And it was such a success story that, being a skeptical journalist, I couldn't quite believe it was true. I had to go see it for myself, and I was thrilled to discover that it checked out. You've got a situation where these are some of the poorest countries in the world. Niger, for example, ranks 147th out of 150 countries on Earth in the Human Development Index. Very poor place, largely dependent on agriculture. And yet, over the last 20 to 30 years, there has been a revolution in how the farmers in Niger, and now it is spreading to Burkina Faso and Mali, how they do agriculture, and it has very profound effects on climate change and adapting to climate change. I traveled there, and I met a man. If you fly into Burkina Faso, you fly to a place called Ouagadougou, which I must say I'm doing a radio piece for NPR about this. It is wonderful to say that you are flying into Ouagadougou, and then the paved road takes you north, and it ends in Wahiguya. And if you travel outside of Wahiguya about 20 minutes, you meet a man who happens to be illiterate and a gray beard, but is as much of a technical innovator as anybody in Silicon Valley. And he is one of the people who has innovated this process that is now spreading across Western Africa. And it is essentially bringing together agriculture and forestry, growing trees in the middle of your fields. They grow millet there, they grow sorghum, and what has saved them over the last 20 to 30 years is that they're also growing trees. Now, mind you, not planting trees. Whenever you speak to a Western audience, the assumption is that these trees are being planted. If you're fairly well informed, you're thinking about Wangari Maathai, the wonderful Nobel Prize winner out of Kenya, who has been trying to plant trees there. In Western Africa, they tried that. It is not something that lasted. It is too expensive, and it is too risky. They planted about 60 million trees over the last 30 years. 80% of them died. And part of the reason for that is the climate. Another part of the reason is that in many cases the farmers on the ground were given no incentive to really care for them. The project was done by Western donor agencies who just kind of top down said, oh, we're going to plant a lot of trees here. What the farmers are doing instead is allowing the trees that naturally sprout every year. They are nurturing those trees and allowing those trees to grow. And so Mr. Yakuba Sawadogo, who's the farmer I mentioned earlier, he discovered this about 30 years ago, and it's actually a revival of an ancient technique that was used there in the old days. And it fell out of favor under the Western imperial governments and then the more modern African corrupt governments who seized the trees and said that any tree belongs to the state. And so you no longer, as a farmer, you no longer had an incentive to allow a tree to grow up. But when that law changed, partly I'm duty-bound to report, partly because of pressure from Ronald Reagan's State Department in the 1980s, who said private property rights matter, and they were right about that. Once those farmers owned those trees, they had an incentive to let those trees grow. Now, why would you want trees to grow in the middle of your field? You would think that doesn't make much sense. It gets in the way of the crops. But in fact, as Yakuba Sawadogo would explain to you in the Moré language, he doesn't even speak French, he says the forest and the trees act like a pump. When the air comes in, it's hot, and the trees cool it because of shade. Right? So the temperatures that are being experienced by the millet and the sorghum that is underneath those trees are about 6 degrees C lower. That's about 10 degrees Fahrenheit lower. That can be critical in terms of whether that millet lives or dies. But that's only part of it. To me, the most amazing thing I learned in that region, and I traveled throughout Burkina Faso, throughout Mali, and you found this virtually every farmer we talked to, because they've seen how it works. If you allow these trees to grow up, you have shade, you are increasing your production, doubling it and tripling it, partly because of the shade, but also because you the soil is holding water much more. What little water comes, because the tree's roots are aerating the soil underneath, the ground holds what little water comes. And water tables have actually risen. Water tables that were declining by a meter a year are now up 5 meters, 7 meters, 10 meters in the space of 15 years, so that now there is water there, which of course makes all the difference. Another wonderful thing that trees do, they stop the wind from blowing the seeds away. In the old days, farmers would have to plant 3 times a year, 4 times a year, 5, 6 times a year, because the winds would come and blow the seeds away. That doesn't happen anymore. And in addition, the trees provide mulch. And when the leaves fall, that is organic agriculture, an organic addition to the soil. So the soil fertility increases. The seeds and the pods also help to feed livestock. And the livestock are healthier, and the livestock's manure also adds to the fertilizer. So you've got a completely organic kind of system. And the yields, as I say, have gone up double, triple. Talked to another one of the farmers there who said, you know, his land was about 6 acres. He said, and, you know, in the past, I would fill 1.5 granaries with the products. Now I fill 3 to 4. It's an amazing kind of story. And of course, as you might guess, this has dramatically reduced malnutrition in these areas. In areas where during the hungry period they used to lose children at distressingly high numbers, they're not losing a one anymore. And the rural incomes are going up because, as I forgot to mention, those trees also provide firewood that you can sell. So it has been an enormous success story. And because it's so successful, it is spreading organically, if you'll pardon the phrase, from one farmer to the next, one village to the next, throughout vast areas of Africa. As I report in the story that you will hear on the World, the PRI broadcast next week, this is probably the single largest environmental transformation in Africa, mm-hmm. in a positive way. And nobody has heard much about it, I think partly because our business likes to focus on the doom and gloom, partly because you got to go there and see it, and it's a hard place to get to, and partly because it concerns very poor people who, for the most part, the outside world could not care less about. But these are people who did absolutely nothing to cause this problem, and yet who are on the brunt of dealing with it. And they are representative of people like that throughout the world. You know, most of the people on this planet live at less than $2 a day. There's a billion people who live on less than $1 a day, and about 3/4 of them are in the rural areas around the world. So solutions like this are incredibly encouraging, especially because they are passing it from one to another without much involvement by Western donors or aid agencies or their own governments, except insofar as making sure that they do have the property rights to do this and providing some help. There is a role for outside assistance, but it is not the big mega projects, and it is certainly not GMOs, which will only make you more vulnerable, because GMO research goes into about two or three crops, and that's not what you want, as Sarah mentioned, in a future where the vulnerability and the variability of weather is going to be so much greater. You want to have diversity. And because of that, these farmers are spreading it one to another. Where we could really help is to help spread this idea further through things like just providing buses that take farmers from one area to another area where this is happening, letting them see it for a week, and then taking them home. That's all that has to happen. And even with very little outside funding, this has spread so widely that in Niger alone, you now have 5 million hectares of trees, 200 million trees that have grown up in the last 20 years. 5 million hectares is about, about 10 million acres?
Something like that. I'm not sure of the
acreage. Anyway, it's a very large, and this will this image will capture it for you. It is now so prevalent that you can see the border between Niger and Nigeria via satellite.
Wow.
The U.S. Geological Survey has done these pictures for the researchers, and they'll be on the website at the world.org's radio program next week. And needless to say, they do not have this going on in Nigeria. Why? And this is an OSI consideration, I think. Why? Because there's no human rights in Nigeria. There's no democracy in Nigeria. There's a dictatorship in Nigeria. And farmers don't own those trees. So there's no incentive for the farmers to keep those trees growing. Whereas in Niger, right across the border, it is the green is literally visible from outer space. So this kind of success story, I think, is very important. Now, can it do it forever? No. If the outside world doesn't do its part and absolutely close down the growth of emissions and, as I said earlier, start to pull the carbon out of the atmosphere, there's only so far that any adaptation strategy can carry you. These people are enormously resilient. They would put us to shame. I remember one night there. It was the hottest place in the world that day. We were just south of Timbuktu, which was the hottest city that day, and we were staying in a place that had no air conditioning, of course, and a little trickle of water that came out of what was sort of a shower. And I didn't sleep that night. It was too hot, and I woke up in the morning feeling very grumpy and a little sorry for myself, until I heard over the wall the family next door, and looked, and there was the mother, who was carrying on her head the water, which she had fetched from probably 500 yards away. And that was going to be the water that they were going to use for their cooking and cleaning for the rest of the day. And they, needless to say, did not have a fan or air conditioning or anything like that. And they lived like that every day. And I quickly readjusted my attitude and said, you better get over it. And it is an amazing thing, the resilience of people there. And when I talked to one of my colleagues about it, and he said, yeah, you know, we here in the West, the water doesn't come out of the tap for an hour and we panic. Mm-hmm. And people in Africa, you know, it's usually said in climate change circles that adaptation, you know, the rich are going to find it easier because they have more money and they can do things like build seawalls or develop GMO corn, drought-tolerant seeds. But my research and what I've seen on the ground suggests that it's the people of the poor around the world who are going to be far better able to deal with what's coming because they are dealing with that now. Having said that, though, I want to reemphasize they cannot deal with unlimited climate change. Their meteorologists are saying that there could be 3 degrees C, that's about 5 degrees Fahrenheit, of increase over the next 40 years. You know, the old people are dying now in the heat that we experience there. We cannot do that for both moral reasons and for self-interested reasons. We're going to talk about that in a little while. But one of the other places that I went to, and we'll talk about this in the question and answer, is China. Because, you know, that's 1 out of 4 people on the planet. They are going to be very hard-pressed to feed themselves under climate change. And what you're looking at in that case is not just if they have to go out on the world market, you're going to see food prices skyrocket, and you could see that government fall. So that's not in anybody's interest. So all of us have an interest in helping people everywhere to adapt to climate change and to mitigate the problem. And I just want to emphasize, though, that there are positive things happening among the very poorest of people. And if we just do our part and help spread that information, there is a lot that can still be done. So thanks for your attention, and we'll go into the questions now, I guess.
Sounds good. It's a very interesting comment, observation you made, Mark, about how people who live closer to the bone are much better prepared for adaptation than folks like us who are dependent on all kinds of technological and more sophisticated supports. It's very good. And I think one other reason why this might not have spread into Nigeria is you have a government that is basically living off its oil exports. Mm. So not only is it a dictatorial regime, but it's also a big oil exporter as well. And the fact that this is happening spontaneously, this knowledge being spread from farmer to farmer and community to community, really speaks to grassroots change.
Absolutely.
All right, why don't we open it up to discussion and questions and observations?
Including from you online, folks.
In this cap and trade bill that just passed the House, you know, is there a mechanism for looters to get allowances by financing some of these agriculture products you're talking about?
Yeah. The question was, there's a cap-and-trade bill passed called Waxman-Markey bill right now that's been passed in the House. The Senate's taking it up. And what Charles is asking is whether the kind of agricultural offsets that Sarah was talking about are counted as credits under this regime.
Actually, one of the reasons why the bill passed as narrowly as it did pass is because they actually mobilized support for it from a number of the farm states, because there was strong lobbying from the part of quite a number of influential farmer organizations to build into the bill the opportunity to do particularly the sequestration through soil management and a number of other things that is in the bill and certainly will be in any Senate bill that would pass, because it's a core part of building the constituency for action on climate change here in the U.S.
And is this only for domestic sequestration?
Right now, that's only for domestic. Yeah. There's actually provision in it for doing some sequestration outside of the United States. There's provision, but not as I can recall, a lot of details. If someone else here may have some of more of those details.
If you talk about doing it in other countries outside the U.S. for U.S. credit, does that not raise the specter of environmental colonialism, in which certain countries feel like they're being used as plantations to absorb our emissions at a cost? And I've heard those kinds of objections as well.
There are some groups in the developing countries that are very concerned about that. My view is it's all about how it's negotiated, on whose terms. And right now, most of the kinds of initial carbon trading systems we have are very much set by the buyers.
Right.
And I think one of the things that's starting to develop now is alternative mechanisms that allow for a fair type of trade, and also to do it in ways that local people have some say over what's done, and actually get multiple benefits from it, far greater than the funding they might get through a transfer.
Good. Yes.
To this point about the cap and trade in the U.S. agriculture, the problem is that the credits will be given, if this bill passes the way how it is, not on the basis of additionality, not on the basis of new projects that the U.S. farm will create, but on the basis of what they are doing today, which means basically the credits will be created for nothing. So this is one of the weakest parts of the bill. I mean, that has other big parts too, but this is definitely not a plus. I mean, we're going to create a balloon of useless credits because this was no additionality in it.
Right.
And if there's no additionality, those credits simply are fake.
My understanding is that there are at least provisions in the bill for having fairly strict, we don't know what that is yet, monitoring of what is produced, and that there does need to be additionality. The biggest issue that I see in the weakness of the bill is actually that we're not capping agricultural emissions, and it's a very significant amount of emissions. But there are numerous problems with the bill, unquestionably about it, and we'll see what comes forward. But I think it actually can't be overestimated the extent to which that farm lobby has played a role in actually getting any climate change. My view actually about this whole negotiation is right now we're in a phase, this is my own personal view, we're in a phase now where the most important thing is to get everyone in the country moving toward climate change action. And the more winners there are in the system, the better. And one of the things that I actually, there's a lot of problems with the cap and trade system, but one of the things that I like about it is it creates a class of people who win from action on climate change. And the tighter the regulations are, the more they win. So you start to get a whole group of people who wouldn't be the ones you'd think would be the environmentalists, like your example of the farmer, who have an interest. It has to be done right. We should be auctioning off all the credits. There's a lot of things that we should be doing in that bill. But I think finding ways, these are major political action that we need to move into here, so we're, you know, I believe we should keep moving forward and see how we can do.
I'd just like to append to that. Let's remember that Barack Obama, as a candidate, ran on the idea of 100% auction of those permits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he is now backing something that is way less than that.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a lesson in that, which is the enormous power of the status quo and the corporate lobby inside of Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And as candidate Obama told us a number of times, the only way to overcome that, president alone cannot overcome that.
Yeah.
You have to have enormous pressure from below. I think a lot of people then kind of said, okay, well, we've done our part. And in fact, we needed to redouble that pressure. And there's still time to do that. And a number of the environmental groups, I think including Greenpeace and others, are putting organizers into the congressional districts and pressuring their congressional representatives to do the right thing on this. There needs to be a huge, huge push on that between now and the Senate action on this, because the bill as it stands, I agree with Sarah about, you know, we want to get people moving, but... You know, this bill is so fatally flawed including something we haven't touched on, but it removes the existing authority of the EPA to regulate this stuff.
Yeah.
That is a real mistake. And you know, I assume that Obama is going along with this stuff because he thinks he can't do better. His science advisors on this are excellent. He has to know that this is utterly, utterly insufficient as a mechanism. And so that, again, is where we come in, is that we have got to be pushing from below at the Congress, at those centrist voters, at the centrist representatives and the others who are dragging their feet on this.
Let me add one other villain in the piece, I think, that's holding us back a good deal. And that really comes to Mark and my alma mater, and Charles as well. I think the press has done a really, really bad job in covering this issue. And I mentioned the press in my remarks because I think it's from press coverage that's consistent and ongoing and thorough and that really gives this story its due is the way to build the kind of public pressure and knowledge that will result in the kind of political changes that need to happen both in this bill and in a much larger way. So while lots of people are fond of beating up on the oil and coal industries or on big agribusiness, to me, the real villain in this piece has been a very negligent press. It was conned by the fossil fuel lobby into an artificial balance by giving skeptics the same amount of airtime as it gave to mainstream scientists. And that also really has to change, I think. So
I wanted to just follow up on something that Mark, I think, alluded to early in your remarks, or you did someone did. And just using the example of California, I think there's still a very widespread failure to understand that climate change is going to create problems for us here in the United States. So it's sort of like, well, the rest of the world wants us to have a climate bill, and we need to do that, and we got to show that we're acting because I guess those charts look bad. But the idea that it's actually going to affect us is really not, I think, largely there. It's beginning to happen in California because there, as you mentioned, I mean, it is very scary what the models show for the future of agriculture in California. And if we have a collapse of some of the major agricultural systems in California, which is a large part of the agricultural GDP, significant exports, certainly to the rest of the country, we're talking about needing at a minimum to do a lot of restructuring of the food systems in the United States. Some of that may be for the good, but there's still big costs associated with shifting around those systems, and that's just in California. Florida is certainly another place where we're anticipating some very substantial shifts in the kinds of agriculture, and this is just on the food side of things. So we need to be I think that the general public has not been acting in that bill. We're having only the corporate interests act because the public is not acting.
Again,
and
I
think this is where we need
just
to
go back, just to underscore what you're saying. Again, coming back to my alma mater, the press, they did not make the connection when you had 700 people die in Chicago from a heat wave in 1996.
Yeah,
they did not make the connection with Katrina, where it's absolutely clear correlation between atmospheric warming and more intense storms, as well as not making these connections. So anyway, let's hear more questions we have.
We have a question from an online viewer who asks, agriculture is facing a double bind. To do farming on a large scale, farmers must use fossil fuels, but they need to reduce fossil fuels. Do you have any suggestions?
I would question the premise there that somehow we need to have large scale farming. That is not the case in most of the world. That is the American model, and it is a model that's the reason that agriculture is such a huge contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. In China, for example, the officials I interviewed there said, you know, yeah, we'd love to do much more large-scale agriculture because they think it would be more efficient and all that, but we can't do it because of the social explosion that it would set off. Because in China right now, land is a form of social security. And although there's been a lot of movement to the cities, most Chinese still live in the countryside. They farm very small plots of land, and that is their social security, and they will not have that taken away. And that's not necessarily so bad. Again, if for the half of the world that lives on $2 a day or less, most of them are farmers, and they eat what they grow. Now, it is very good if they can also sell some of what they grow to markets, but they're eating what they grow. And so a small plot of land, it is easier to do ecological agriculture there and organic agriculture there. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a that's another one of those positive signs that we overlook and that we need to build on. And not, but it does challenge this notion that the only way to feed the world is through massive farming. That's what's starving the world.
Right. I'd like to add something to it because I think I am also sympathetic with the caller's question because it is a double bind. One of the reasons that we have such large farms in the United States today is directly related to the economics of mechanization that occurred in the 1970s and 1980s, where you had to have a minimum size of farm in order to be able to buy these very, very expensive high-tech systems, and they had their benefits. But the entire economic system that we have for farming right now is predicated on high levels of fertilizer use producing nitrous oxides, high levels of fossil fuel use. And I actually, you know, maybe I spend a lot of time working with farmers, and I don't so much say these are the bad guys. I mean, this is the way the economic system was pressuring. There were very strong economic pressures in the marketing system for monoculture. There's all sorts of things that explain why we have the kinds of farming systems that we have today. But the reality is those farming systems will not be appropriate farming systems in another decade or two. And so the sooner that we all, as a society, we don't sort of, point fingers, you're bad, you're good, you're, what are we going to do? How are we going to make that transition to a different kind of agricultural system? How are we going to do that with the least pain possible for the most people? And I think that is the question. But the idea that somehow there's going to be a solution that some you can keep your high fossil fuel, high fertilizer use, high trucking, you know, cost systems is probably not going to be the case. And so we should start preparing now rather than later.
Let's go here and then Bob.
Hi, I'm Martha Lurkey with the Open Society Institute, so you know, disclosure and all that. I'm very curious, one of the things that we're looking at in one part of OSI is in sub-Saharan Africa and trying to work with higher education on climate change adaptation. Not to talk directly about that, but one thing we're trying to understand in Africa is to what extent Africa talks to itself about issues that are going on. So you bring up this very interesting example of just busing farmers to each other and to see success stories, and that could in some ways maybe solve a certain number of the problems. I'm very curious, however, to hear from Sarah, does Nairobi know what Niger is doing? Is there a dialogue on the continent itself, particularly across Francophone, Anglophone, Lusophone communities? And to what extent is, it seems to me that there's a big problem, and I've seen it elsewhere in the world, when things are donor-driven. The reaction, a good reaction to that problem is to have a very strong local voice. And have you seen it?
Yeah, now, I think it's been a huge issue for Africa for quite a long time, that major decisions about the strategies that are going to be done in Africa, because they're so donor-dependent, are made outside. They're not made as a result of political discussions and bringing different stakeholders together within the countries. It's beginning to happen in places like Kenya. There's a few places where you're starting to see some of that go on within the country. But I think overall communications between the countries is not very strong. There's some very interesting new initiatives. I'll just raise one. It's an initiative that Eco Agriculture Partners does some work with, which is called Terra Africa, and this is an initiative that's jointly with donors and national governments, and it's sort of bureaucratically been a bit complex because they've been trying to get together all the groups in Africa who are working on what they call sustainable land management. Hmm. And this is, you know, how do we get more yields, but manage the waters well, manage the soils well? And very recently in that process, they've been bringing in climate change in. Because, this is one of those happy coincidences that Mark was mentioning. Most of the things that you need to do for sustainable land management, which is agroforestry, conservation, tillage, soil organic matter, rainwater, all the things that you need to do actually have positive benefits for both adaptation and mitigation. So they are trying to create a platform throughout Africa whereby people who are doing work, including NGOs who have historically driven all this work because the formal groups were just doing seed and fertilizer. And not, again, not that there's anything wrong with seed and fertilizer, but it really is not a solution. And I think that any initiatives that could be done, I'd actually be interested to talk with you more about that, because I think there's a number of new platforms that will make it possible to have a lot more communication, not just between universities and elites, but actually between groups of practitioners who could support one another. So I think there's a good network that could be built on in Africa, but it's not being built on in Africa.
I would say I agree with a lot of that, but the specific case that I know about, this regreening initiative, it's doing exactly what you're talking about. It's called Regreening the Sahel, and as you know, the Sahel stretches from Francophone Western Africa all the way across to Nairobi and Ethiopia. The week that I spent in Burkina Faso and Mali, I was driving around with about 25 local NGOs who had all been working in the field of economic development, most of them in the field of agricultural economic development. None of them knew about this particular thing, even though, as they said, all the farmers know, you know, and it gave them a real reality check of we have to get out into the countryside a little bit more. And so the goal now is for them to be encouraging this in their work and in all of their networks, and they are now going to be sending it back up the chain. One of the people who was on the trip he's a Malian, and he does a lot of consulting for the EU and Western donor agencies. And he said, you know, until now, I had always thought of agriculture in terms of external inputs, meaning Western money and big irrigation. Right. And now I see that it doesn't have to be that way at all. And of course, they all know that the problem with Western inputs is not just the control, it's that the money gets pulled out from under their feet. You know, as soon as the world economy goes into crisis, it's like, oh, sorry, we know we promised you that money, but can't deliver it. And that's what makes something like the Regreening Initiative sustainable, is that you cannot take that knowledge away from those farmers. Once they have it, they don't need money, they don't need new equipment, they just need what's between your ears. And that is spreading throughout these areas, and it would be very easy and I think appropriate for outsiders to help foster that, but you don't have to do it in a top-down way.
I mean, there's these farmer-to-farmer networks that can be, but they are facilitated greatly, and there's certainly even parts of the Niger case came from some strategic support for some of that facilitation role in farmer-to-farmer, but it is not high-tech,
it's
not expensive.
It's a very different approach than, for example, you see coming out of the Earth Institute at Columbia, where let's get a $1 billion from the Western world, and we're going to go in and we're going to give you know, wells, and we're going to give irrigation and health clinics to every village in Africa. Well, guess what? We're not. We're not going to do that. You know, I think Jeff Sachs is a brilliant guy, and I admire his passion, but that is just not going to happen. I'm not even sure it should happen.
Well, one thing I think that is important, the Niger case was a very interesting case in that it was in a very low producing type of agricultural system that's on the margins, in which doing good resource management could quickly make very significant impacts in this. There are other parts of Africa that are extremely densely populated as many parts of Asia, in which they're already doing extremely intensive kinds of agricultural systems. And those can be significantly improved with some of the knowledge that's there, but I think there are many of those places actually do need more actual investment, physical investment, infrastructure investment. And it is going to take some resources for some of that stuff, and a lot of it can be done with local resources. I'm not sure we should completely write off the ability to bring in additional resources to support that. I actually think that's going to be important for the adaptation. But it's going to be providing support for locally driven, locally designed, and locally based things so that the input is a strategic and catalytic input rather than input.
Right. External input.
That's how I would look at it anyway.
We spoke tonight about the failings of journalists. Russ, you did, which is true. And we talked tonight about the failing of the public to appreciate the problem sometimes, which I guess is true. But I'm wondering if anyone in the panel, and I'm not just talking to you, there are journalists in the audience and people who have written books on this too, if you think that we who write about this subject have also failed in the way that we address it, that we've not been able to convince the public that Karl Rove and the oil companies and those guys have a better vocabulary for reaching America than we do. Should we be doing something different?
I'll leave that to you, journalists.
I don't see it as a question of vocabulary. I see it, and as I mentioned in my remarks, Bob, what got me into this was finding out that the coal industry was paying some people under the table to say this isn't happening. And the journalists bought it, and they got conned into this false ethic of balance that was very inappropriate in this case. And what I'm concerned about is there are a lot of journalists who are trying to get this out. There are more journalists who are picking up on it. At the same time, as you're seeing very negative things happen to the press overall. And I'm talking not just about the decline of newspapers, the layoffs of reporters, but I'm also talking about the conglomeratization of media, where, and this is a little bit off point, but I think it's very important, where you have, you used to have independent news outlets who would support reporters with passion. Now you have, in many, many cases, conglomerates that have bought papers and have bought news outlets, and they do polling to find out, for focus groups, to find out what sells. So they're doing much more celebrity coverage. They're doing much more self-help. They're doing many more trivial medical articles. And really, it's sort of the tail of Wall Street wagging the dog of journalism. So unfortunately, I don't think it's a question of what vocabulary we use. I think when the journalists were trying to bring this out, they didn't realize the extent of the opposition and how powerful the, not so much the agriculture lobby in this case, although it played a role, big agriculture, but certainly the coal and oil industries of their disinformation campaign was totally targeted at the journalists. And it was extremely, extremely effective. And they basically used the same playbook that the tobacco industry used a generation before and updated it and so forth. So, no, I don't see this as a challenge in terms of changing the vocabulary. I do see it as a challenge to news outlets all over in terms of changing their priorities and realizing that this issue, and I'm talking the whole climate issue now, not just the agricultural aspects, this issue really is the fate of our future collectively. And it's not printed that way. It's not written about that way. It's not given that kind of weight. Even the coverage of Waxman Markey is very detailed, but it doesn't really touch very often on what the larger implications are. And I don't think that's a question of vocabulary at all.
I'm not a journalist, yeah, but I just wanted to comment, maybe because I'm not, I'm more willing to give you guys a bit more of a pass on this, because in Europe, there's widespread public recognition,
right,
of this, and they're obviously doing some things, but they are having a devil of a time to actually making the kinds of transformations. They're ahead of us because they got the price of oil and gas higher than we did. And every day now in our newspaper, we have our coverage. I live in the Washington, D.C. area, and we actually have unusually good coverage of the climate change issue, I think, relative to some other places. But for all those articles, every single day, there is a full-page ad that says, the climate bill is bad. It's going to give you $4 a gallon oil. We must be able to do something else to deal with climate change. And, of course, the reality of the whole point of cap and trade and everything, we want to get the price of oil up to $4.
Right.
That's the whole idea.
Right.
So even, you know, setting the terms of the debate, but that's the political piece of it. But the other piece is it's just hard. We're really talking about major societal transformation. To me, it takes 20 years. It takes a generation to switch. Unfortunately, we don't have the time with climate change. But I fault, more than I fault the press, I fault leaders. I fault our political leaders, I fault our business leaders. I mean, they're people who are positioned in such places that they're supposed to be looking to the future of the country, and they're not looking to the future of the country. It's not that hard to find out about climate change. And I would say we need more of a mobilization that's targeted at leaders in all of our sectors to do what leaders do, which is to help people make hard decisions, help them have a vision for moving forward that's a positive enough vision that people will make those hard contributions.
I'd like to
very briefly add here, because I think Bob does have a point about vocabulary, and it segues off of what Sarah said. neither we nor the leaders, including Barack Obama, who has said this a little bit, have done enough to talk about the upside of this, the solutions.
Right.
It has been too driven by doom and gloom.
Yep.
Instead of saying that, look, as he said again as a candidate, and occasionally says as president, that making the changes that we have to make are going to, it's going to be transformative, it's going to be difficult, but it is going to lead to a better country.
Mm-hmm.
It is going to lead to huge numbers of jobs. There is an enormous economic opportunity here. And, you know, Charles Alexander let me write this in Time magazine a few years ago, calling for a global green deal that is now a very sort of popular idea around the world.
Yeah.
And leaders are getting it, and the Secretary General of the UN gets it. And Obama is not using that vocabulary, but that's basically what he's talking about with green jobs, but he has not talked about it enough. And our, I would say also that the environmental community and therefore the press who reports on it, there has not been enough of a sense of what fighting this is going to do to make your life better. And, you know, that is what gets people to vote. That is what gets people to get up in the morning. It is very easy, and I think all of us who work on climate change, as I've been covering it for 20 years, it can get pretty dark. And so God knows you need a way to tell people, yes, there's darkness, but you will feel much better if you march toward the light, and the light is right there, and it is going to make jobs for you. It's not going to be good for ExxonMobil. That's true. Let's be clear about that. Let's be upfront about that. I don't think that's a political loser in the eyes of the American public.
No, they're not going to do so bad either.
You know, just like saying that if we had a real proper economic policy, it wouldn't be good for Goldman Sachs. I think the American people would be okay with that. You know?
Mark, let me take this one step further from both of what you're saying, because I agree with you, but I think you're both stopping short in one sense. If Obama or Gordon Brown or Sarkozy or any country really began to make major transformations, both in its agricultural practices and certainly in changing its energy diet, that country would immediately put itself at a competitive disadvantage to other countries, given the intensely competitive sort of hyper-globalized economy that we're living in. So I really think what's required for this to happen is not just will on the part of our leaders, but a willingness to do this in a really coordinated way so that all these countries, the industrial countries, are making these changes in lockstep, and that way no one leader is afraid of putting his own country at a political or economic competitive disadvantage and losing re-election and all that goes along with it.
Well, I think that's kind of what they're talking about now at the G8, and that they've instructed their finance ministers to go off and see what
right.
it will take to do that. And so one has to hope that that will happen at Copenhagen. But I'm not sure that I would buy the idea that it's going to put you at a competitive disadvantage. There's a whole other side to that. Why is it that you think that there is, leading sectors of capital around the world, and especially in China? China can see that the 21st century economy is going to be green.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they keep harping on about technology transfer,
right.
because they don't want to be left behind in that.
Right.
They know that they are seriously invested into the old infrastructure and that that is going to be a problem. So in fact, I would argue that, I think this is seen in corporate headquarters and finance ministries around the world, that you want to get out front on the green technologies. You know, what is the biggest exporting country in the world today? Not China. Germany. Why? Because Germany has invested in green tech. They've got a plan to get 40% emissions reductions by 2025,
yep.
And that is seen in Germany as a good deal. Now, the difference, I think, is that, I was mentioning with somebody the other day, you know, they're able to think more than 2 months in
right.
the future.
Right.
And they've got a business
That's
sector
exactly
and a political
right.
sector and a public sector who agree on the role of government, on the role of government planning, and forward thinking. That is not the case in America.
That's right.
But there is where I think America is losing the economic competitive race globally.
Well, it is, but I also think it's retarding this transition in general because of that.
Right. Now, there was another question.
Yes.
We have a bunch of questions building up online. Botan asks, are multinational institutions like the African Union helping to speed up transfer of best practices? If not, why not? And can they be urged to do so? And I'm going to add one more, if I may. Corey in Melbourne asks, I am very sympathetic to Sarah's point about recovering farm carbon debits as well as credits in cap and trade. But it tends to stall because farm emissions are so hard to measure and monitor, and because they vary substantially with diet, breed, locale, et cetera. Given this hurdle, how can we address both debits and credits in a way that encourages innovation?
Do you want to take the one on the African Union?
Those are good questions. God bless you in Melbourne. Australia is clearly the major industrialized country that is feeling the brunt of climate change first and hardest. As far as Africa, unfortunately, what I have discovered, and somebody may know more, the answer seems to be, so far, no. The African Union has not been terribly good on spreading this alternative way of thinking. There is still perhaps a kind of a symbiosis with Western donor agencies and the assumption that still the conventional thinking of the past. For example, the president of Senegal has apparently convinced the European Union that what they need to do is fund a gigantic tree planting program to build what he calls a green wall across the Sahel of planting trees, despite the fact, as mentioned earlier, that 80% of those trees have died in the past and will die again in the future. But there is a symbiosis, oftentimes an unfortunate symbiosis, between African governments and Western donor agencies that have very little to do with the welfare of the people on the ground. That underscores once again your point about the importance of grassroots and academic and those kinds of exchanges rather than at the top levels of governments in Africa.
Yeah, I think I agree with the importance of the grassroots and networks, but in terms of what happens in Africa, it's also is quite important because of the nature of the governments in that place, that there is governmental support for this. And I have to say that it's been frustrating because there has been relatively little action until this year. I would say the last year, you're starting to see real engagement with the issues. Really late and not enough and they're still, they're in the discourse, the disagreements, the discussion about what's really going to benefit Africa and what's not. But I'd say they're just beginning at the level of African Union, the NEPA, the New Economic Policy for African Development, et cetera. But really some support, really, I think this is a major need. We need champions among the presidents of Africa for pushing forward. Right now, they're really beginning to realize, starting to get scared about the impacts. They're starting to see the results of what, because Africa is being one of the places that they project is going to be the hardest hit. So they're worried about that, and they're mad because they didn't cause this problem.
Right.
This is caused
Absolutely.
By this. So, you know, they are very much interested in trying to get adaptation funding to help them. The question is they don't have strategies yet in place for what that would look like. So you're going to end up with the problems you were mentioning. In terms of the monitoring thing, I'm actually very optimistic. We've been working a lot with different groups who are doing monitoring of emissions, particularly carbon-related emissions, but also some with methane and nitrous oxide, which are the three greenhouse gases most relevant to the agriculture sector. And it is, as the caller was saying, there's a lot of variation in terms of how you manage things, et cetera. But we're talking about looking for changes that are large. We're actually not trying to find 2% reductions in emissions. We're talking about getting 50% reductions in emissions, 80% reductions in emissions. And I think that we need to move beyond what has been the tradition in the developing countries, particularly of doing very small projects with extremely precise measurements of all sorts of things. No, in my view, my example is, you know, we need to take all of Niger. We need the 5 million hectares in Niger, and that you can monitor. And in fact, there's other things that are quite difficult to monitor. Most of them are in the process right now of very good scientific work being done on developing monitoring methods, including at a landscape scale, multi-component activities at a landscape scale. Yeah. There's a whole group of multidisciplinary group at Cornell University that are working. The Terrestrial Carbon Group is working. There's groups in Australia is doing some of the best work around this, actually. I think within 5 years, the measurement and monitoring issue will be largely solved. I actually think that's not going to be a constraint in the future.
I would add one point in terms of this carbon debit credit ratio idea. And this is an idea that came from a group of people we worked with. This particular idea came from a utility company president. And he proposed, under any kind of global climate agreement, a progressive fossil fuel efficiency standard that goes up by 5% a year. And what that means is a country needs to produce the same amount next year with 5% less carbon or 5% more with the same amount of carbon and so forth. And the way you measure that is very, very simple. You don't have to worry about adequacies of meeting adequacies of commitment and differentiation and all this extraordinarily complex and minute ways the Kyoto process did. You simply measure a country's gross domestic product against its total carbon fuel use, and that ratio has to change by 5% a year. And that would be tackling this problem on the level that Sarah's talking about rather than on a very minute project-by-project one. And it also seems simple enough, very simple to monitor, very simple to implement, and very simple for national economies to grasp. So I would throw that in the pot as well.
Do we have other
questions?
Here comes your mic.
I wanted to push for a little more of something Mark was raising. I remember in high school, in the Middle Ages or so, we were all very reassured by the Green Revolution was going to resolve all the food, agriculture problems for a growing planet. And now you're talking about some really interesting scientific responses that could also be very significant in solving the problems in climate change. But I felt that the whole Green Revolution idea was very kind of fed the apathy of the public, that we didn't have to change anything. Science was taking care of it. And I feel like today the public apathy, and I agree, you can't totally blame media for this. Public apathy is still a big problem. And Mark, I thought you were raising something more along the lines of a different PR strategy and in terms of promoting these changes. Do you have any thoughts about that, or where that would come from? Who would, what would generate that kind of strategy?
Well, I think actually food is an area that is, in the American context, there's a lot of encouraging stuff going on. Look at how food, with the work of people like Michael Pollan and Eric Schlosser and the movie Food Inc. that's out now, that has really jumped to the top of the American consciousness, especially among young people. The idea now of fresh food and organic food and how bad industrial food is for you and how bad it is for the planet, that is close to becoming a mainstream idea now. And just a few years ago, it was kind of wacky, right? I mean, I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, and there it's
totally
been
mainstream.
Very mainstream for a long time. But as a result, that's an interesting example that has now spread across the country, and it was again, it was partly the work of independent authors who wrote the right kind of books, but it has much more to do, I think, with all due respect to Eric and to Michael, with what individual people do in their own neighborhoods. And you just can't get past that. That is how political change happens. That's how cultural change happens. It's you in your own neighborhood, the people that you know in your workplace, in your place of worship, in your neighborhoods. That's how change happens. So, yeah, it's all fine to have public relations strategies, but really what it's about is doing that at a local level, and that's what's worked with food. I mean, I think you're going to see, and then, at a certain point it does pick up a critical mass, and then right. The politicians join the parade, and the media joins the parade. I mean, all the media now is happy to do those stories. And we have to create that same kind of momentum on climate. And I have been told by environmental organizations in this country for the last couple of years that that's what they're investing in. They're planning to do more grassroots work. Well, they're not there yet, judging by the kind of bill we got with Waxman-Markey. And there's a lot that has to be done between now and December.
I would also say that there is actually a difference between the dynamic of what happened in the case of the Green Revolution. Actually, that was when I went into my career because of all of that, right? That was what was in the discourse. But it was about people starving over there. And the reality about the Green Revolution, with all of the very serious consequences that it had in many ways in many places, we did not have a repetition of the large-scale famines in India and China as a result of this big push in providing grain. And it was way more than the Green Revolution technology. It was governments putting this at the top of their priority list for developing irrigation systems and extension systems. It was way more than the technology. It was about institutional strengthening in the rural and agricultural sector to the extent that it had benefits. But it wasn't about over here. And I think the thing with the challenge right now with climate change is it's all about us having to change our food systems here. And one of the things that I think is actually the most useful is this proliferation of various kinds of climate footprinting methods. And you can go climate footprinting, where you can go online now and look at your lifestyle and figure out what you're doing and figure out, okay, what kind of emissions am I responsible for? Can I make a plan for how I'm going to reduce my emissions? I'm a company. There's now a lot of climate footprinting for companies to do. The food industries have actually begun. There's a series of climate footprinting methodologies now that are going into the food industry. Now, unfortunately, right now, most of those concentrate on food processing and food transport. Well, guess what? Most of the emissions from food are not from processing and transport.
Right.
Even the long-distance transport that everybody talks about, it's mostly from the production systems. And that has not yet, because of the complexity of that was mentioned by the caller from Australia, we're just now figuring out how to do more effective footprinting along the entire value chain of food. And in Europe, there's actually there's now starting to be climate labeling on food. And again, unfortunately, it's mostly about processing and transport. So if you do a good job on that, they'll give you a pass for 90% of your emissions being on the way you manage your the farms. But I think that this is actually a hugely useful tool. I encourage everybody, if you've got a company to do it, if you're in your own home to do it, to go to your grocery store and figure out what's the footprinting, get your grocery stores to start publishing some of the climate labeling, and buy stuff that you think is climate friendly.
And eat less meat, friend.
Yeah.
You got to eat less meat.
And if you're going to eat meat from sources that are more sustainable.
I would add one other thought here, which is that if you're looking for sort of a transcendent kind of more universal value that would attract people to this issue, I mean very strongly, again, one part of what I said in my opening remarks, this is the only phenomenon that affects every single country in the world. And conversely, if the world did what it needed to do, with individuals playing their role in neighborhoods, but governments playing their role and alliances playing their role, if we were to totally change our energy systems and our agricultural methods, that I think, and if that were done in concert, in a coordinated way, so that all the countries did it together without taking advantage of one another, I really think you could say that could be the platform for a whole new era of global peace. And I think given what a combative and fractured and kind of warlike state we're in, both with all the civil conflicts that are going on and the international conflicts that have gone on and the ones that we're terrified of that may be coming down the road, if you can say this kind of coordinated effort around the world on these various fronts is really a platform for a new era of peace, that I think is a way of maybe appealing to a higher...
One of the things that changed the world's attention on HIV and AIDS was that it was linked to security. It's linked to political stability.
Right.
And that totally transformed the level of attention it received. People didn't really care that anyone was dying.
Right.
And it could be the same with
and this is
climate
the
change.
Same in terms of long-term security for humanity.
We have quite a few questions from our online viewership, and I'll throw out two or three right now, if that's okay. Jean asks, focusing on U.S. farmers who have been pressured into a series of drastic changes and who are now going to be asked to make even more drastic changes, what kind of support will they need and deserve from the larger society? Question two is, I hear the claim made that all climate models are circumstantial and therefore fundamentally unreliable. How can I answer that contention when it's made? And then one more, and I apologize to any online viewer questioners who don't have their questions answered. What is your view of biofuels, and how do you see this factor in the food security climate change solution?
OK.
first one?
Farmers, what kind of support do farmers
need? Oh, farmers to support, yeah, okay. I do think we need to move beyond deciding who caused this problem in the, we need to look at that, but we need to move beyond it because I actually think that farmers are being asked to do something that's pretty unprecedented worldwide, which is farmers are no longer the producers of food. They are the producers of food and they are the producers of ecosystem services that are benefiting everybody else. And so I do think we're talking about a new social contract between urban dwellers and non-farmers and farmers, because we're asking them to play this role, and I think that there does need to be a great deal more institutional support, support for farmers' organizations, support for farmer education, new mechanisms that will make it easier for farmers to make this transition. I don't think we should be in a punitive mode. These are really genuinely things. We want to stimulate the innovative capacity of farmers and farmers' groups and create an environment where they can get access. So I actually think it's very, if we're serious about this, we're going to provide support for farmers and farmers are going to agree to produce the kinds of climate benefits in conjunction with food that they have not had to do in the past. And hopefully those will have benefits for watersheds and they'll have benefits for biodiversity and other kinds of benefits as well. So I think that's key and hype. We're not serious if we're not providing that.
We only have a couple of minutes left. Let me take the next part of the question, which had to do with the climate models, and then Mark will speak to biofuels. It's easy to pick at climate models. I think it's very important to understand two things. One is the evidence does not rest on climate models. If you basically measure the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere for 10,000 years, it was the same amount, 280 parts per million, until the Industrial Revolution. It is now close to 380 parts. So that's a direct measurement. And so we know the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere traps in heat. There's no dispute about that whatsoever. And finally, what I would say that to me is extremely important is you have an agreement among more than 2,000 scientists from 100 countries reporting to the UN in what is the largest and most rigorously peer-reviewed scientific collaboration in history. The work on models is one part, you have many other parts, and then you have all the physical evidence of the melting of the poles and migration of the species and the heating of the oceans and the increase in violent weather. And I think if you put all that stuff together, the models have actually done a very good job. They haven't done a perfect job, but I think it's very misleading to seize on the models as being the only and most telling piece of evidence here, because they're not.
To add one sentence, models have been consistently underestimated.
Absolutely.
The impacts
of climate
change. That's
also very true. Right, exactly. And why don't we give Mark
a question? As far as biofuels, simply stated, the biofuels are not necessarily a bad idea, but how they have been introduced so far has been a pretty bad idea. They have focused on basically corn and ethanol and things that are not very efficient about providing benefits, and has had the effect of driving up food prices by taking acreage that could be used for food and turning it into fuel. But let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. There are ways to produce biofuels with other products, the cellulosic kinds of weeds and so forth, that can be used for biofuels and that are being used, and that's where we have to have future investments and research and development. But that is going to create a bit of a problem for presidential candidates going to Iowa. They've got to be willing to tell the truth about ethanol.
All right. Thank you. That concludes the session, and thank the Open Society Institute again so very, very much for inviting us, inviting a wonderful audience, and for making the whole presentation possible. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.